All right. We got another Friarside chat for you guys, and I've put together a few of these so far. When we got Katana Collins on, Scott Snyder, when we had Eric and Julia Leewald on from the X-Men animated series. But Doc, you wound up, you know, digging deep into your Rodeo Clown connections, and you got this one for us today. It was the Rodeo Clown connections, right, or was it a different past job that you had? I forget.
I've had many past jobs, so yeah, that's a.
Doc, which one was it? I can't remember.
There was Alien Autopsy Specialist. Professional Wrestling Manager is one of my favorites, along with the Sasquatch Wrangler.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the Doc, I mean, I'm trying to give it to you here for you to introduce who our guest is today.
Yeah, I gotcha. I'm still new to this, so picking it up on the fly here. But today we have Cullen Bunn. One of my favorite writers. I reached out to a couple of friends of mine who put me in touch with Cullen. So I'm very excited to actually bring a Friarside chat to everyone today. And Cullen, thank you so much for taking the time and being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Finally, Doc pulls out the win on this one. I mean, that's right. You know, oh, yeah. Scott Snyder and X-Men animated series. Finally.
He's
bringing the big guns.
Honestly, Cullen, when Doc and I started doing this, he, like, one of the first people he said that he wanted to get on was you. He's like, we got to get Cullen Bunn on. I know, my buddy Freddie knows him and stuff like that. You know, maybe we could down the line get him. I was like, yeah, absolutely. So he was like, when we saw that Bite Size was coming out, you know, the day that this episode is dropping, right. Doc and I started planning right away. So we got to try and do this now. And then he was, and I was like, all right, Doc, it's you. You're running the show. Go ask him. Go get it done.
So I talked to my friend Freddie, and Freddie says, you need to talk to Ronnie. And I was in a fantasy baseball league with those guys, and Ronnie was very very generous and very accommodating. He said, here's his email. If you need anything, let me know. And you were very gracious to respond back very quickly. So, you know, here we are, and very excited about it.
Yeah, now I'm happy to be here.
Now, with Bite Size, and it's coming out with AWA Studios, the first thing that jumps out to both Doc and I is that, you know, you're writing about self-aware robots. I mean, and we already got enough shit going on in this world with the disease and the politics and stuff like that. And we've seen years ago, before any of this crap, that there was a robot citizen. I believe it's in Saudi Arabia. I don't know if there are more. That's why I'm hung up on just that one individual. Why did you feel like now was a good time to write about self-aware robots?
You know, first of all, Bite Size has actually been in progress in some form or another for a couple of years. So it predates the nightmare that has been 2020.
Okay.
But to some degree, it's for the very reasons you just mentioned that I think it's time for this book. Because this, yes, it is a book about self-aware robots. And in the era of murder hornets, it's like, what else do we need?
Right? Yeah, that's right. Forgot about those. Yeah.
What else could we possibly need? But this is a book that is full of hope and is full of fun and is just exists to bring a little joy into the life of the reader. So I think it's the perfect time for a book like this. This is definitely not a heavy book in terms of, you know, heavy themes. I mean, there's a little bit of stuff in there, but it's it's obviously Bite Size is an all ages book, and I absolutely mean that. It's a book that I think adults can read and enjoy, but it's also a book that has kids sharply in focus. And I want this to be a book that, you know, parents can get their kids and the kids can sit down and read it and just have fun with it. And maybe not worry for the little bit of time it takes to read the comic. You know, maybe it takes them away for a little bit.
See, I've seen Terminator 2 enough to know that sentient robots are absolutely terrifying. And then you combine that with what they're doing over at MIT and knowing that your past work in horror, it makes me believe this might not be an all ages book.
Yeah, I know. And look, it's a lot of people have said that to me is why are you doing an all ages book? And what most people don't know is, you know, I love all ages material. I love it. I mean, one of the first things I did before I ever broke into comics, I wrote a middle reader horror novel called Crooked Hills that came out with a small press publisher. And I did a book with Oni Press called Terrible Lizard, which was an all ages book that I did a few years back. I've got a book coming out from HarperCollins called The Ghoul Next Door. That's a middle readers horror graphic novel that I'm doing with Kat Ferris. So this is really, actually, it's in my wheelhouse. This is the kind of stuff, you know. Yes, I love the really dark, horrific, awful kind of stories. But this is I also love the kind of stories that got me into, you know, movies and comics and things like that when I was much, much younger.
But when it comes to writing anything for, you know, all ages or middle age, you know, young adults, what is something scary still? Like, how do you toe that line? What is the most, like, because I hear young adults, there are different, you know, topics, of course, that you can cover. But when it comes to horror, I feel like that would be a difficult area to kind of navigate.
Well, you know, you rely on different skills to some extent. The things that make a story sort of scary, and I don't consider Bite-Sized a horror story. There's definitely some scary moments in it, especially in the first issue. But the thing that brings that out is the same across the board. If you worry about the characters, if the mood is set right, if the tone is right, you can make a very scary story that anybody can read. And I think back on movies, right? The Changeling, which is a horror movie, is one of the scariest ghost stories that's ever been put to screen. I mean, it is a terrifying movie, and it's rated G. I mean, it's a you know, people don't even think about that they're it's not about gore. It's not about, it can be, you can use gore. I don't invite size. In an all ages book, you can hint that there might be gore and kids can say, oh, this could be gross. They could say something about it, but you can't show it.
Gotcha.
But you can lean on the menace of, you know, these robots. They're kind of kept, especially in the first issue, they're kept off screen for the most part. They're off panel. You see hints of them, and you see them moving around. You see the effect they're having on the environment. And when they finally show up, there's definitely a sense of menace. What do these things want? And are they going to harm this family that you hopefully come to care about to some degree? So if you care about those characters and you can get the reader to care on an emotional level, and then you get the mood just right, you know, you can make a scary story that even for kids, you can't necessarily, you know, have some, you know, you can't have adult themes and things like that, but right. you can make a story that kids like. And the other thing is I don't write down. I just try to limit the ways that I'm going to get those scares. I don't want to write down to the reader just because they're a little younger, because kids are a lot smarter now than I was when I was their age. And I was pretty smart.
Yeah, I've got a 4-year-old, and she surprises me every day. Much she's already running circles around me. That's for damn sure. But
Bite Size is definitely more of a science fiction fantasy story. There, like I said, there's some scares in it, especially, you know, early on, and there's definitely some sort of thriller elements and action elements and danger that the characters go through. But I wouldn't classify Bite Size as a horror story, though.
Well, Joe will be the judge of that, because he scares very easily, very akin to probably his 4-year-old daughter. So we'll know, you know, after he reads it for real.
I said the same thing when we were talking to Scott Snyder. I had to read The Batman Who Laughs During the Day, because if I read that before I went to bed, I was up all night. And so,
all right, Joe, this kid's book about robots might be too much for you.
Although I have been spending an awful lot of time catching up on Harrow County, because that's you know, one of my favorite books, and I read that a while ago. So between, you know, the things that you write about, you know, in Harrow County and Manor Black and some of your other books, and even though this isn't a horror book, do you find the idea of, you know, sentient robots terrifying? Is that something that, even though this is, like I said, a young adult, you know, book, you would maybe write about that in a more adult theme later on?
Haven't you guys ever seen the Tom Selleck movie Runaway? Of course sentient robots are terrifying. Any kind of robot's terrifying.
I
there is something sort of inherently creepy about artificial intelligence. And 100%. A few years back, when I was working with IDW and I was doing a lot of stuff with the Transformers universe, I was doing like crossovers with Transformers and stuff. I was at their offices and they brought in a panel of robotics experts to just give like a talk to the public. Mm-hmm. And they introduced a concept that I feel like I should have known about, but they introduced this concept of utility function. And they told about how robots are given a utility function. And they said, and those functions can really go to an extreme. And they gave an example of a robot that's job was to clean, sort of like a Roomba type thing, but its job was to clean debris. And it cleaned the area that it was in so well that there was no debris. In order to fulfill its utility function, the robot started like slamming into the walls until stuff would fall, until it was cracking the walls and creating debris so that it would have something to clean up. And that terrifies me. And, you know, and I've revisited that. I've visited that concept in several things. I was doing X-Men Blue for a while, and I did a whole thing on the utility function of the Sentinels with X-Men Blue because it was such a bizarre, you know, such a bizarre concept to me that a robot fulfills its job and has nothing to do.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, could it then try to make the problems that it's there to solve?
Yeah, imagine you being the wall and it just smashing your head on the floor until there are bits and pieces all over the place and it has to clean it up.
No, I mean, it's scary. You know, what if it's a robot that's job is to perform surgery and there's no one to perform surgery on? You know, it's there's all sorts of, you can go in all sorts of crazy directions with that concept. That scares me the most when it comes to robots. That's the scariest idea is the utility function.
I didn't know the utility function was a thing. I didn't have a word for it. Now I know.
Yeah.
I'm not big into
these robotics experts could have just been blowing smoke. I'm dumb enough that I wouldn't have known if they weren't, but it sounded real.
It sounds good. It sounds legit to us.
Yeah. So I'm terrified. I'm out.
Couldn't they like go and do research on other stuff? Like, I don't know, like illnesses, curing cancer. No, you got to go and freaking, you know, make sentient robots who have these stupid functions. I don't like this at all. I don't like that this conversation is going at all, but Colin, I do want to ask you about, with Bite Size, you touched on it before, getting the people to care about these certain characters that you're going to be dealing with. I know there's a family in there, and I believe it was two kids are in the story. And then you have the two robots, right? Is that all correct?
Well, there's the family with two kids, and they have a dog.
Okay.
And the dog plays a big role. And there's five robots. There's five robots that escape from this government lab. These robots escape from the lab that invented them, a military lab. And they hitch a ride off to the distance until they can no longer hitch a ride. And then they scurry off into this home of this suburban family on Christmas Eve on the night of this big blizzard that blows in. So the family's stuck in this house with these five robots. And that's really sort of the idea originally came from this notion that, you know, you wake up on Christmas Eve and you've got this coolest little robot toy that you've ever seen. You're like, this is the coolest, most advanced toy. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, oh, that's not a toy, you know, and I wasn't supposed to get that as a gift. And what, you know, that kind of, that's kind of what set that was sort of the kernel of an idea that spun out into Bite Size.
So is the focus more on how like the family is dealing with these robots, or is it the robots, is it focused on them trying to, accomplish whatever their objective is?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, it's definitely a story about this family dealing with the robots, but it's also the robots aren't just a faceless menace. They have, each robot has its own personality driven by its utility function. Each robot has different goals and agendas, and they're doing different things. And at least one of those robots is a big troublemaker, and that's really where the chaos and mayhem comes from, is that this one robot his utility function, I feel like, is pretty unique, and he is the sort of the catalyst for a much bigger story. And it's the robot that you see on the cover that's coming out of a stocking and looks sort of like a worm. That's our biggest troublemaker in the book.
Love it. Okay.
I got a 10-year-old nephew that is getting into comics, and one of the things he wanted for Christmas was he wants to start writing his own comics. So I bought him a bunch of different art books and things like that. I'm definitely going to grab an extra copy of this book when it comes out next week and put it in there with his stuff, because it sounds like it'd be right up his alley. Yeah,
perfect age. And look, when I was 10 years old, there were a few things I loved more than robots. I mean, you don't grow up, when I grow up, and not have a healthy appreciation of robots. You know, I grew up in the era of R2-D2, yeah, and you know, the Daggett on Battlestar Galactica and things like that. So, and Twicky on Buck Rogers in the 25th century. So I was surrounded by a love of robots, you know, from a very early age.
That's awesome. So you talked about, you mentioned how this sort of idea has been in the works for a couple of years, and AWA is a brand new studio.
Yeah.
So how, you know, what sort of led you to bring this story to AWA? Cause I know you've worked with a bunch of different, you know, publishers, the big two with Marvel, DC, but also IDW and some of these other ones. What made AWA seem like the right fit for this story?
Yeah, well, you know, I pretty much think, and I was on a panel not long ago with a number of AWA creators, and they asked that question, why you come to AWA? And I think almost every one of us had the same answer. And that answer is, it's Axel Alonso, the editor-in-chief there at AWA. He brought me in to that company. Axel was an editor when I first broke in. He was a senior editor when I first broke in at Marvel. And he quickly became the editor-in-chief at Marvel. So I worked very closely with Axel the first few years when I was exclusive to Marvel. But then throughout my career, it was Axel was definitely a champion for me and was working with me a lot. And I wouldn't say anything here that I haven't said to Axel to his face. And he could be a tough guy to work with. I mean, he's not an easy guy to work with. He's demanding. He wants he wants things to work a certain way. He demands, you know, a certain level of quality that has to come through. And if he's not getting it, he's going to tell you. And I really appreciated that. And the other thing he is it shouldn't be as uncommon as it is. But with Axel, I always know where I'm standing. If he was angry at me, there was no question that Axel was angry at me. Yeah. Because he would call me and he would say, "Hey, I'm angry. This is why." You know, if I'd done something wrong, he would let me know. There was no, there were no false pretenses with him, and that meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
And when he left Marvel, he called me not long after leaving Marvel, and he brought up AWA and what they were doing and talking about kinds of stories I might be able to work with, you know, what I might be able to do with them. And Bite Size came from those initial conversations.
Oh, nice. Cause we've been big fans of AWA, especially recently. I've been reading a lot of their books, and the stories that have come out of that studio so far have been excellent. So when I saw Cullen Bunn, Bite Size, AWA, antennas went up, and was very excited.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a very different story from the other stuff that they've been doing because of the age level of it. I mean, they haven't done an all ages thing yet, and I'm hoping this is successful enough for them that, one, we can do another Bite Size series, but two, they can spin off and do more of these all ages books from other creators and everything else. Because I do think it's important that we get kids to read comics and try to not just read comics, but to fall in love with comics and whatever, you know, and whatever makes a person fall in love with a comic, it's different across the board. Yeah. But you guys, obviously you love comics. You're not just a casual reader. You love them. I mean, yeah, there's something about comics hooked you and it won't let go. And that's what happened with me when I was a kid. And I want to see kids get that kind of inspiration from these books.
Yeah. This is not going to,
because look, it's completely selfish. Yes, I've written a lot of material that's, you know, young adult, middle reader, teens, adults, really dark adult material. You can't, you know, you couldn't show your kids. But if I hook them with Bite Size, then I got them to buy all the way up as they're growing older, you know.
This isn't going to play well for the listeners, but my daughter actually drew this morning. I don't know if you can see with the glare, but it's her first comic.
Nice.
It's her first comic. She drew that, you know, a different character in each panel. And You know,
I hope you put that in a acid-free bag and board.
Oh, you know it. You know it. So I, you know, occasionally when I go to the store, I've been bringing her with me a lot more lately. And so she's been, you know, grabbing the, you know, the My Little Pony comics.
Sure. My Little Pony versus Transformers.
Yes, that was one she picked up. And you know, she's just learning how to reach it. But she just loves, you know, she'll see me sitting in my chair reading my comics. And she'll go over and grab her little stack. And she asked me one day to bag and board them for her. So sure. I have. And then she opens it up and she just sits there and she goes, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's the most adorable thing. But
And she's four.
Yeah.
Well, let her read Bite Size. She can get Bite Size. Won't be too much for her.
Oh, no. Okay. We'll sit down. We'll read it together. I'm sure she'll love it. But this is what you're talking about. And this is what's great. And this is what I'm trying to do, you know, with my nephew as well, is get him, you know, get them into a loving to read and having a passion about something. And now he wants to draw and write his own. Which is great, and I really, you know, really hope that Bite Size does do well, you know, and does, you know, spur a lot more books, you know, for AWA.
Right. Yeah, it's you know, I think it's a fun book, and like I said, I told you we've got the one robot that you see on the cover that looks like a worm, but we also every robot in the book has a different design, so each robot looks different, and they were designed sort of. And Nelson, the artist, he designed each of them. He calls it, scary cute or something. You know, yeah, he's got a funny name for it because the robots are really cute, but they're also, there's a little bit of menace to them and a little bit of worry about them. But they're also kind of fun to look at. They have these great bulbous eyes that, you know, look, you know, that are just charming
But terrifying at the same time.
A little bit. Not too bad.
Just enough.
How did you end up working with Nelson on this project? What made him seem like the right fit for this?
Well, Nelson, this is a completely different kind of book for him. If you look at his other work, it's not this kind of sort of exaggerated animated style. Mm-hmm. But he was Axel brought Nelson into this project as well, And he got real excited about it because it was going to be a departure from what he's done before. And because he got the chance to draw these robots and design these, you know, these cute little creatures and things like that. So I think that's what really excited him about the book. And, you know, we had a great few initial conversations on the phone where we just batted ideas back and forth about what these robots might look like, what the family might look like. And it was just a fun, you know, it was a fun conversation. What their house looks like. I mean, we really, you know, we had a lot of discussion because we were, you know, in my mind, I think back, you know, there's a lot of movie influences for Bite Size, especially like the Amblin movies. And I always, one of the things that always strikes me about that era of movies is the constant state of chaos that the houses are in. I mean, if you watch E.T., or, you know, our Goonies or whatever. The houses are just boom. It's just a mess. There's so much going on. There's stuff everywhere. There's stuff going on in every direction. And I really liked that idea and wanted to capture that sort of notion in the comic, is that I wanted it to feel like one of those families from those 80s movies that just everything is going on around them.
That's a nice little touch that I would never think of. And it totally changes the vibe of things. And that kind of leads me to the next thing I wanted to ask you. When we've talked to writers before about, you know, how they're working Marvel or DC, and then they go and do stuff in, you know, indie comics as well, and, you know, it's Kickstarter whatever. For you, is that something that's essential? I know you do a lot of it, or would you be, if someone gave you the option of, you know, you could just write Marvel, you could just write DC forever, you would just stick with that?
Yeah, so if someone came up to me right now and said, you can write Marvel and DC and you can have that job forever, or you can write your creator-owned books and the stability of your career will forever be in question, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd pick creator-owned books in a heartbeat. It's more rewarding. The stories are better. And I'm not trying to bash Marvel or DC. I liked working for those guys. I really did. I love those universes, and I love the opportunity to contribute to those universes. But there is a completely different feeling when you are creating your own stories. And I started in the world of creating my own stories, and I'm never going to give it up. I mean, and I've been offered exclusive contracts from big publishers, and they've said, but you can't work on your own stuff at all. You know, my first contract was an exclusive with Marvel, and they left me big carve outs to do creator own stuff because they knew that was important to me. But I've been offered contracts where, like, yeah, you're not going to be able to work on creator own stuff. And I had to turn those contracts down. My career would be completely different if I hadn't. But, you know, you're not going to take the indie work away from me. And I still look, and I'm doing books for Valiant, and I love working on the Valiant books because I'm contributing to a bigger universe. And I love the feel of that. I love the way there's just a different interaction when you're working on those. You know, when I'm working on creator own stuff, you have editors, but it's my story. And in the end, you know, it's my way, or it's going to be what I want to do in those books. With, you know, not work for hire material, there are other forces at work that are going to control those stories. So it exercises different writing muscles, so to speak. But there's also a different kind of collaboration on the editorial level when it's done right. And that can actually be great and improve the books and make it, you know, and make them awesome. But I don't own those characters, and there's always going to be a little bit of a feeling that I don't own this. It's not mine. And I feel like I've been that way since I was a kid. I mean, I remember playing with, you know, Star Wars figures and Micronauts and G.I. Joes, and I had them all playing together, and I didn't play. It wasn't this character from the Micronauts. I was making up my own characters that this action figure represented, because I didn't feel like I wanted to tell the story of the Micronauts or tell the story of G.I. Joe or tell the story of the Star Wars characters. I've seen those stories. So I wanted to tell my own stories, and I was using those action figures to do that. So I've been that way forever.
Yeah, so that's, you know, with our show, you know, we each pick a book each week that we talk about that we try to, you know, introduce to new readers to the books. And one of my favorite things, I almost always go with an indie book. I mean, I love Marvel and I love DC, but just like you said, I love the indie books because there's so much, the stories that the writers can tell and the directions they go in are vast. And you get some really, really creative stuff. And so when reading a lot of your stuff, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the show is the horror stuff and how, you know, in general, it terrifies me. I don't watch horror movies, but I love reading horror books. And I loved Harrow County. I love Manor Black. And so what is it? You write them so well. So what is it about the horror genre that fascinates you and drives you to write such great stories?
So this sounds weird, I guess, because the horror, you know, first of all, horror stories, there's so many different kinds of things you can do within the genre of horror. You can have action horror, comedy horror, kids horror. You know, there's all sorts of types of stories you can tell. And I love that. You can tell any kind of story in the horror genre. I've got a horror romance that's coming out in 2021 that I'm super excited about.
I like something.
And, you know, it's so you can tell any kind of story.
Yeah.
But to me, horror stories serve a couple of purposes. One, I think it's a very hopeful genre. Even in stories where the heroes die horribly, you know, they don't make it out of the story alive. In the best of those stories, they fight with everything they've got to make it through and figure it out. And maybe they don't succeed. But to me, it's very hopeful that in the face of these overwhelming terror, they still put up that fight. And that's hopeful to me in some way. There's just something to the fact that I'm alive right now. And I'm going to do everything I can to keep it that way. It may not work out, but I'm not giving up. Yeah. And to me, there's the thing is that I don't give up. I'm not going to give up. And that's a hopeful side of the horror genre to me.
Was there a specific book or movie or series from like your childhood or, you know, earlier in life that led you to want to lean towards horror as much as you have in your writing career?
You know, when I was very young, I really liked the horror anthology books that DC was doing, like House of Mystery and House of Secrets. And then Charlton was putting out a lot of horror anthologies. And I don't know if they were coming out when I was young or if I was just reading them. Back in those days, you could go to a garage sale and buy a stack of comics like this for a couple of dollars and just get a random assortment of stuff. And my dad loved yard sales. So he would go out and he'd bring back, you know, stacks and stacks of comics for me. And I would read those horror anthology books, and I really liked it, really loved them. And I dropped off of reading horror for a long time. I started reading more fantasy stuff and more science fiction. And I just wasn't, for a while, I just wasn't that interested in horror stuff. I still loved like Halloween. I still loved going to haunted houses, but reading and stuff, I wasn't doing, you know, doing those stories. In high school, I decided that I wanted to become a special effects makeup artist.
Huh.
And that got me into reading magazines like Fangoria and Gore Zone and things like that. And that was my dream for a long while, is that I'm going to be a special effects makeup artist. That's what I thought I was going to do. And because I was reading Fangoria and reading Gore Zone and reading all these magazines that had reviews of horror novels, I started picking up the horror novels that they were reviewing just to, you know, check those out a little bit. And that just sort of, you know, fueled the love of horror fiction. And then I decided, no, I don't have what it takes to be a special effects makeup artist. It's not my after all.
What could have been? You could, instead of writing Darth Maul, you could have been the character who gave, the person who gave Darth Maul his look.
Right. I could have been. And, you know, it was so, this is how my mind works and how broken I am as a person, because I, you know, this was my thing throughout high school, you know, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, I was going to be a special effects makeup artist. And I dropped it as soon as I graduated. I was like, nah, not going to do that. And,
really?
I moved away, and then I came back to visit some friends, and we were in a store somewhere, and we met some people that I went to high school with. And they're like, so how's things going for you? Everybody knows I want to do special effects. Did you get into doing, you know, special effects? And I was like, oh yeah. If you watch the new LA Guns video, and LA Guns, that's how devious I am. I didn't think Guns N' Roses or something would be believable, but I said LA Guns, and they could believe that or never see that music video.
Oh, that's tremendous.
I tell you know, just stories about how I did all the effects and makeup for the LA Guns video.
Oh man.
And
they bought a hook, line, and sinker.
Oh yeah. They're like, wow, that's great. You know, then I was like, I get the heck out of here before they really start digging deep. I gotta go. Yeah. You know.
Oh,
and but during that time I started dabbling in writing my own short stories and stuff like that. And I just really fell in love with writing. So between my 12th grade year of high school and during my freshman year of college, I decided, no, there were some times, I'm going to be a police officer and I'm going to be a fighter pilot. You know, there are all sorts of things I wanted to do, you know, I met with the, you know, the military recruiters to see, you know, what I would have to do to be a, you know, to fly jets, and realize, no, I'm not smart enough. And, you know, I explored some things, but during my freshman year, I decided I was going to be a writer, and that's what I got my degree in. I got a degree in creative writing. And I just, you know, I wanted to tell stories.
Well, you told that LA gun story so well. Yeah. It fits. Right.
Well, all writers are liars at heart.
That's what you say. You try Secret Service or anything like that? Because you could probably do that.
No, I didn't. I met with the recruiters. CIA. And I said, what's it take to be a fighter pilot? And they said I was not smart enough, basically. And then
they told you weren't smart enough. Oh, I thought you were.
They didn't say those words. They were nicer about it than that. But they said you're not going to be a fighter pilot.
Okay. Well, there's actually, then they would have told you straight up.
Yeah. And then I wanted to go into the police, and I remember there was a while I was determined I was going into the DEA, and I remember it was funny because there was a show that started airing on TV called DEA, and I watched the first episode with my mom, and it was about a guy who had just been recruited by the DEA, like a young new recruit. Okay. So, and I was like, see, Mom, this is what it's like. This is what it's going to be like. You know, and his life is great. He's exciting. He's busting criminals. And then he gets shot and killed at the end of the episode. And my mom just looked at me with like you're not doing that. I was like, it's just a TV show. It's all full of lies. That's not what it's like. You know?
Spin zone again.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then I just decided, you know, I really wanted to tell stories, and that's where I've been ever since. It took me a while to be able to do it professionally, but I tried I had been trying to break into, you know, telling stories professionally since college.
I mean, and we're glad that you did, because I mean, you know, Doc loves your indie stuff, and I love some of the stuff you've done at Marvel too. I mean, I brought up Darth Maul. That's one of the things to me that stands out most that you did there. I mean, it was only 5 issues, if I remember correctly, right?
Sadly, it was 5 issues.
See, and that's the thing. I remember, I just didn't realize the time that was what it was going to be. And when I saw it in that fight, I was like, come on. Like, we need more of this character. You already screwed him in Phantom Menace. I know you brought him back in the shows and obviously now the movies. But I'm curious, Cullen, if you had the chance to, you know, have a say in if he got a show or if he was, you know, a big villain in the next, like, Star Wars story movie, like if they built off the Han Solo movie, what would you do with the character if he got a larger opportunity?
For Darth Maul?
Yeah.
I was really fascinated by the crime syndicate stuff where he was, you know, in the show where he kind of built the crime syndicate and everything. And they hint at it, obviously, in the Solo movie and stuff like that. And I would have liked to have played in that area a little bit. You know, it's interesting, that Darth Maul book, I was scared going in to work with Lucasfilm because I, you know, I've worked with other licensors that have been nightmares. And I said, well, here's Star Wars. This is going to be the biggest nightmare because it's one of the biggest properties. You know, it's one of the biggest, you know, universes. This is going to be horrible. And it was such a pleasure to work on a Star Wars book. Lucasfilm was so awesome to work with because they weren't this company that was like, no, 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 you can't do that. No, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. They were just additive to the story. Little things. Like I said, well, I'd like Darth Maul to fight a Rathtar because that movie had just come out and the Rathtars were awesome. And they were like, yeah, that's great. Let's put him on the world that Han Solo visits in the Lego Star Wars adventure game. Because they were just very big on use this world because that's where it would take place. They were big on adding stuff to it. And, you know, and there was a lot of stuff with the Sith that I did in that book, some stuff sort of subtle and behind the scenes. And I was like, they're never going to let me get away with this. And they didn't even blink at that stuff. The stuff they blinked at that they didn't let me do. I had Darth Maul in that book teams up with a group of bounty hunters. And I love those bounty hunters, especially Cad Bane. Whatever I would have done with a Darth Maul series, Cad Bane would have been central to it in some way. Yeah, he's
awesome. That guy. I love him. I love Cad Bane.
You know, take Boba Fett all day long. That's fine. Cad Bane is the 100%. Best bounty hunter.
100%.
But
so happy.
I wanted to put a Jawa bounty hunter who used droids as his weapons. And they wouldn't let me do it. They would not let me use a Jawa bounty hunter.
A Jawa bounty hunter. Oh, I like that. I can get behind that. Wow, they wouldn't let you do that.
They wouldn't let me do that. And I wanted the Jedi. He meets a Jedi or a Padawan in that series. And I had a different plan. Not to spoil it for anyone. I had a different plan for that Padawan at the very end. And they said I could not do it. I had to end the story pretty much the way I ended it. Yeah, I would have loved to write more Star Wars in general. I wrote one other Star Wars annual. I wrote one Star Wars annual, and I would have loved to have written more Star Wars. But it's one of those things. When I wrote the Darth Maul series, it was a completely different editorial team. The editorial team changes, and they have their own kind of crew they want to work with, and you know the direction they want to go.
Yeah.
Because Lucasfilms always, you know, I still talk to the folks at Lucasfilms, and they talk about we'd love to have you do another story for us.
Maybe do the story as a show now this time. Movie, something like that. You know, I think you have a good grasp of the character and you want to bring in Cad Bane. I mean, what more do they need?
Yeah, let's do a Cad Bane series.
Hell yeah.
Cad Bane, Ahsoka Tano, boom, right there. We can just
I think an Ahsoka Tano series is gotta happen, right? They're gonna do a TV show, I'm sure, but there's gotta be a comic. I'm not the guy to write it. They need, I think there's someone better to write an Ahsoka Tano series, but I'd read the hell out of it.
Yeah.
You know, that she probably is my favorite Star Wars character.
I think that's starting to become the, like, not the majority, but that her fan base is growing big time.
Yeah, no, a lot of people really, you know, just love, I mean, Darth Vader's always probably going to be my top, but, you know, Ahsoka's really cool. I mean, she's a really cool character. And yeah, in that annual, I was able to write Darth and Luke for a little bit. So that was exciting. And, you know, I got to write a story with Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader and R2-D2 in it. But, you know, I'd love to write more in that universe for sure. It just hasn't been in the cards since that Darth Maul series.
Well, we'll get the wheels moving. We'll get that Cad Bane series going.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That'd be absolutely fantastic.
I don't know that Cad Bane has the legs to sell a bunch of books. And there's the key.
I'll buy it all.
Write it for us, you know, and we'll read the hell out of it.
If it just needed to sell 3 copies, I think we could make it work. But as much as I love Cad Bane, I don't know that he has the legs to support a series. And that's unfortunate because I think he's the coolest character around. I think anybody would, but you got to keep in mind, so many people who read those Star Wars comics never watched those shows. Yeah. They have no idea. Like, who's this weirdo in the cowboy hat?
Bring him into the Mandalorian. You could say he's like Yoda, where he ages forever.
Those guys age. Yeah, I'd love to see him. Look, I may wet my pants if Cad Bane ever shows up in the Mandalorian. It would be. And what's great is he works so perfectly in that universe.
100%.
It's basically, or in that world of the Mandalorian, because it's basically a Western.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
Outer Rim's the West, old West.
So I'd love to see a Cad Bane in Mandalorian. It would be the greatest thing. I just wouldn't want him to get punked out. He's got to stand. You know, he's got to hold his ground. He's no punk. That Cad Bane.
I'm ready to run through a wall.
Wily little guy.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So going sort of from one property now to another, we got a big video game coming out next week in Cyberpunk 2077, and you've been writing Cyberpunk 2077 Trauma Team, which I've been loving. One of the things I love about, you know, your writing, Zdarsky's writing, Lemire's writing, James Tynan, Scott said that you guys all write characters so well, and especially in this, you've got a very traumatized main character that you're dealing with. So my question about this is sort of, what got you into this? Are you a gamer yourself, or was this just sort of an opportunity for you to write a really creative story?
So I play video games. I just don't play them very well. I'm really crappy at them. I am the worst video game player, to the point that I was playing some games not long ago as research for another project that I was pitching on. And I was like, I got to play this game in order to understand it. And I pitched the project and I was like, I'm never going to get anywhere. So I called my son down. I was like, you play the game and I'm going to watch so that I get to understand the game, because I can't get through this first level where everybody's shooting at you. So I just watch the games, you know, and we're playing the new Assassin's Creed game right now. So I play games, but I'm not a diehard video gamer. But I was a diehard, and still to some degree am, a diehard role-playing gamer. I loved role-playing games. And the Cyberpunk 2077 game is based on a game called Cyberpunk 2020 that came out in role-playing game form. And I played that as a much younger man.
That's what it was.
Okay. So Dark Horse reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested in this? And I was like, oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. I'm all in for doing, you know, some cyberpunk stories. And I pitched them several concepts. I talked to the guys at Project Red, and I pitched 5 or 6 different ideas for this story, because it was going to be the first cyberpunk comic. And Trauma Team was the one I thought was the lowest on the totem pole for me. I was like, it's the one I like the idea, but I didn't feel like it was a first cyberpunk comic book. I thought it was so specific to one area of cyberpunk. Cause the pitch I really wanted was broad, and it covered every aspect of the cyberpunk world. You know, it was like an introduction to cyberpunk, and they didn't want that. They were like, no, we want focus on Trauma Team. We want this world, this story. I'm like, you know, as you wish. but to in order to tell it, because honestly, it's a very simple story.
Yeah.
You know, a group of militarized med techs arrive at this building that's infested with gang members, and they have to get out.
Yeah.
That's super simple. So I had to take it and say, all right, well, let's take the character now. Let's take one of these characters and let's make them, you know, let's de-simplify it in a big way for that character, for no one else. And I thought, well, trauma team, they're there to do trauma. What if this person is really dealing with some emotional trauma of their own? And that just, you know, it took a very simple story and turned it into something much bigger, because, you know, over the four issues, it takes place in a very confined area. It's not a world spanning story. It's one area of Night City that you're stuck in. So it was important to really delve into that character. Has the last issue of that hasn't come out yet, right?
No, yeah, issue three came out a week or two ago, and issue four is coming out soon.
I'm interested in how I am very interested, because it did not end the way I think anybody thought it was going to end when I pitched the project. So it ends in a very interesting way, I think, and I'm excited to see what people think about it.
Oh, nice!
It's a crazy book, but yeah, and I'll play the Cyberpunk game when it comes out. I'm going to play it. I mean, it looks too cool not to.
You have to now, too.
Yeah, I was talking to my brother about it. He said that someone did a playthrough, and it was 175 hours.
Oof. Yeah. Maybe not. for me, that's like 500 hours.
Yeah,
it's like, right. You know, six of those hours of me trying to figure out, how do I open this door?
Exactly. Right.
I've been so confused by that game, because I feel like it's been teased for so long. I mean, maybe it's just me. I don't know.
No,
so
it's been announced for a long time, and it's been kind of delayed. There are a lot of delays associated with it. I can only imagine that bringing out a video game is one of them. Well, I mean, it's if it's more complicated than making a comic book, which it has to be, it's insanely complicated. Because it's miraculous to me that any book ever comes out, any comic ever reaches the shelf. So a video game, that's another thing altogether. But yeah, it looks like a really cool game. I love that open world concept. You know, and a long game sounds great. I just know that 30 hours into that 150 whatever, I'm going to be like, oh god, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, that's pretty daunting for me, because I'm not necessarily a gamer either. And because the game had been teased for so long, I for some reason thought that I thought the book came first and then the game, and then we were getting a new book from you. So I didn't pick it up initially, because I got to go find the other stuff first. But Doc kind of educated me on it, and he's Doc, I think you're going to have to do an episode on the series before I pick it up, so that way we can tell listeners about it. But one last question that I had for you, Colin, with Deadpool, when you wrote him killing the Marvel Universe the first time around, obviously it's a tough thing. You did. I loved it. I talked about it back on TLDR 11. Such a fun series. But then you have to do it again. And I have to imagine, you know, you're handling properties that, you know, like you said before, Marvel cares about Deadpool. I know he kind of, I'm sure you can get away with a lot more with him based on what I've read, it seems like it. But when you have to go and do that again, I would think that's got to be fairly tough for you.
It was so much fun. So, you know, when I first wrote Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, they Marvel came to me and said, we have a series. We want to call it Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe. And that's all we know about it. So I sat down and I said, this is what the story is. It's Deadpool. If Deadpool was Jason Voorhees and he's killing everybody that everybody loves in the most horrible ways. And then I just embraced it and went for it. And it's a dark story. It's a humorous story, sure, but it's a mean story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was That's Marvel's cool. best-selling book for years. For years, that was Marvel's best-selling book. And it's still, if I go set up at a convention and I bring 50 copies of Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe, it's gone the first day. It's still the book that goes instantly.
That's surprising at all. I think it's amazing. I love that. It was such an, I mean, just
so rips. We did a couple of sequels to that book. And then a few years later, and I think the editor didn't like that I did this, but that's all right. It happens. You know, you got to make your own magic happen. I was at a Marvel retreat, and I had pitched this to the editor sort of on the slides. Like, you know, what if we did a, Deadpool kills the Marvel Universe again, and he just does it again. And the editor was always sort of lukewarm on the idea. He's like, you know, I don't know if it's time or whatever. So I was at a Marvel retreat, and I pitched it to Axel. And I was like, you know what would make us a lot of money, Axel? Deadpool kills the Marvel Universe again. And he's like, yep, we're doing that. And it immediately went on the schedule, you know. And the interesting thing was the Marvel Universe had changed so drastically from when I did Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe and when I did Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe again. Characters were completely different. Different people were in the roles of these characters. New characters had appeared. And I had a whole new batch of ways to kill people and things I could do. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was just a blast to do that book. And there were little things. I never got so much hate mail on a Marvel book as I got when Deadpool kills Spider-Man in issue 2 or 3. I can't remember which one he kills Spider-Man in the first series.
I think it's 2.
He kills Spider-Man. I got so much hate mail over that. How really? Could I do that? You don't understand Spider-Man. You know, it was just, I mean, there was so much anger over that. And I get it because that's what that moment was supposed to do. Spider-Man is Marvel. You know, he's the guy. Yeah. And Deadpool kills him in the most offhanded, awful way. And it's done. You know, within 3 pages, Deadpool kills Spider-Man.
Wait a minute, that was supposed to get everybody pissed off because it just made me laugh.
I knew it was going to piss people off. I didn't know it would piss people off that much, but it did.
So you think this is how Disney should integrate Deadpool into the MCU?
It's absolutely how they should integrate Deadpool. But I'll be angry if I'm not involved in some way. Even if I get one of those stupid cameos that everybody does in the, you know, in all the Marvel movies where they walk up, oh, you're looking for a phone booth? It's that way. You know, whatever. Even if I'm just in the background, you know, whatever. That's fine. That's absolutely what they should do. They should bring me along because I have lots of ideas on how to kill those Marvel cinematic characters. But one of the things that was fun in Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe again is I was like, okay, so in issue 2, I killed Spider-Man and they of the first book, I killed Spider-Man. They and I was just hated for it. So in issue 2, and I never, it's not like we broadcasted that this is why I was doing it. In issue 2 of Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe again, I kill every, that issue is completely dedicated to killing Spider-Man characters. Every death in that issue is Miles Morales, Peter Parker, it's all Spider-Woman. It's all the Spider-Man characters in that issue. I was like, you don't like it when I kill Spider-Man? What if I kill all the Spider-Men? And yeah, so to some degree, it was a little bit of trolling, but it's trolling in good fun. If you read a book called Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe,
yeah, exactly.
If I don't deliver on that idea, then I'm not doing you a service. You know,
exactly.
It's right there on the title. It's got to happen.
It's got to happen. Well,
don't
I hope
read it bothered you.
I hope you survived Donnie Cates. Apparently, he's killing off comic writers in issue 2 of Crossover. You know,
so I don't know if I survive. I doubt I'm in Donnie's in Crossover. But that's, you know, look, I've been killed 3 times in Deadpool comics because Tony Moore's drawn me in as police officer. Officer Bunn gets killed in the first his Deadpool run. You know, there. You know, I get killed in Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe. I mean, it's, you know, that's fine. Kill me off. Yeah. It was a fun book to do. And then with Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe again, we had to set it in a different world. And careful readers will know what world that's in. It's an alternate universe of Marvel that has been famously seen before. But you have to read, I didn't, you know, come out and say, this is this world.
Yeah.
It is a certain alternate Marvel universe that had its own run in comics for a while. And if you read it carefully and if you've read the other material, you'll know what world that's in. And it takes place, you know, between the panels of that other series.
Oh, nice. So, last thing from us, Colin, and thank you again for taking the time with us today. As I mentioned, you know, earlier, the goal of our show is to give you know, one another, Nick and I, but also our listeners, a second chance to, you know, sort of reconsider, you know, books that they might have overlooked in the past. And is there any book of yours that you would suggest new readers to you, if they're not familiar with, you know, to read? And then secondly, what is something that you're reading now that you might, you know, suggest?
Yeah. So first of all, the answer to that question is all of my indie work. You can go pick that up, give it another try. But no, so if I were going to, and look, even the successful books in indie, you know, in indie comics could be a lot more successful. And I definitely think there's, you know, books that need a lot more eyes on them. And if I were going to say, if someone were asking me, what's a book that would introduce readers to you and we haven't read it, you know, I would say first, it's one of two books. It's the first thing I always give someone who's completely unfamiliar with my book, my work. Harrow County, which you've mentioned a couple of times. I think Harrow County is a Southern Gothic fairy tale. It is a horror book, but it's easily read by teens. It's not so horrific that it's, you know, unpalatable. You can easily get through this book, even though the scary moments, even people like you, Joe, that can't take scary, you can handle this book.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I think Harrow County is a great introduction to me as a writer. It's a complete story, ran for 30 something issues, and it's done. So the series is done. You can get all the trades or all the collections and you'd be done. You don't have to worry. Do I have to get more? Do I have to get more? You can get that complete story. And then the other book that I always recommend to people is The Sixth Gun, which I did through Oni Press. It's an epic fantasy set in the Old West. It's a story of six magical pistols, and each one has its own unique ability. And the most powerful of those guns falls into the hands of an innocent farmer's daughter. And she turns her into the deadliest gun in the Old West, but it also sets the forces of darkness on her trail. And again, that story's finished. We ran it for 50 issues with a couple of side miniseries, but you can read that entire series. And I mean, I'm very critical of my work. There's something I don't like about almost everything I do. Sometimes there's a lot I don't like about some of the things I do. I am unapologetic for The Sixth Gun and Harrow County. Every issue of that series, of those series, is great. If you read the first issue and you like it, you're going to love it by the time you reach the end of the series. The Sixth Gun in particular is great for people who only read superhero comics, but they want to branch into indie. It's a very easy jump to that kind of indie storytelling. And either one of those books, great introductions to my work. Yeah. So a series that you might want to check out that I promise you haven't given this book any time, because most people don't know it exists. And it's fun. It's interesting you asked that, because this book is right here on my desk, not because I knew I was going to be talking to you guys. It just happened to, I got it in the mail a couple of days ago. So there's a book called Warlock 5.
Okay.
This is the Warlock 5 omnibus that Outland Entertainment just published. This is the original series that ran in the 80s, late 80s.
Oh.
It is one of the coolest series that you will ever, ever read. And look, I'm not saying this because I wrote the foreword to this edition. I'm not getting a dime for selling extra copies of this. Mm-hmm. But this is the original story. And it was originally... I remember as a kid, it was a 13 issue series. This book has issues 14 and 15, which have never been published. It was done in the 80s and early 90s. It's never been published. It's not a perfect book. It's a mess at times, but there's something about the ambition of it and the craziness of it. It's about these five warlocks, and they control portals on this thing called the grid. And the grid is an access point to all reality. And there's one's a dragon, and one's a sorceress, and one's a punk rock necromancer, and one's a cyborg like a Terminator, and one's the knight. And their job is to protect the grid. The problem is they can't stand each other, and they're always trying to kill each other. And it has amazing artwork. I mean, it's a gorgeous looking, but it's all in black and white, but it's gorgeous. It is one of the books that I think back on all before this came out. I was thinking back on this book all the time. It heavily influences my own writing. It's inspirational. I even got my old floppy copies of the series and I had them bound into hardcover. So I was like, I've got a hardcover. I don't need a new, omnibus edition. And then they said, oh, well, these are the two issues that were never published or in this one. I was like, oh, great. Thanks. Now I can have it. It's a gorgeous book. It's never been collected in this kind of format. And it's a thick book.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's 15 issues of gorgeous, gorgeous art. And wild storytelling. I mean, and like I said, it doesn't always come together the way it should, but it's worth it just for the ride. It's such a bizarre story. I co-wrote with my friend Jimmy Z. We co-wrote sort of a sequel that we did a couple of years ago to this series. But whether I did that or not, I would recommend Warlock 5. It's sitting here on my desk. I love the world. Outland's a small company, but they do some really interesting material and this book is just beautiful. So I highly recommend Warlock 5. The collected edition, they did a Kickstarter for them and they just went out like in the last week or so.
Oh, nice.
And now I think they'll be available on their site as well to order. So
I hope they are, because I know Doc's going to want to do an episode on that. I already saw him write it down.
It's a super cool book. Like I said, I wrote the foreword to this edition, but I would just skip that. Don't read that. Just go right into the comic,
And I was thinking about devoting the first 10 minutes of the episode that we do on that to the
forward. You won't appreciate it as much as you think you will.
We'll do a live reading of it,
Yeah.
But the book starts with knights in the sub, like in LA, in the streets of LA, and they're marching through the streets, and it just gets bizarre from there. Awesome. And it doesn't let up on that bizarre pedal.
The weirder it gets, the better. That's what we want.
Yeah, it's a weird book, but a lot of fun.
But of course, those who have been listening to the entirety of this episode, we brought Colin on to talk about Bite Size, which is coming out the day this episode drops, December 9th, from AWA. And you go pick that up. Doc and I will be picking it up and letting you guys know how we feel about it. Colin, we appreciate you taking so much time out of your day. You're busy and everything. So thank you for talking with us, and hopefully we can check in with you down the line.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. It's been fun.
Thank you very much.